This is Asha Voices. I'm JD Gray. The road to recovery after a brain injury can often include feelings of isolation and frustration. People who experience brain injuries may even feel disregarded by medical providers, such as physicians. That's according to research conducted by today's guest, SLP Jerry Heppner, a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire, studies the experience of people with TBIs and their interactions with healthcare providers. His 2022 article in the American Journal of Speech-Language Pathology, co-written with SLP Louise Keegan, has a title that starts with a striking quote. Quote, "I avoid interactions with medical professionals as much as possible now," end quote. And then the title goes on, "Healthcare Experiences of Individuals with Traumatic Brain Injuries." Jerry and fellow researchers published a follow-up to that article this year, highlighting needs in the chronic phase of TBI care. Jerry joined me to talk about the experiences of people with TBIs and the way SLPs may be able to help them address communication access and barriers to care and connection. I began by asking him about the title of the 2022 article. Where did this quote come from, and what does it indicate about the experiences of people with traumatic brain injuries?
Yeah, so the title came from one of the participants in the study, and we really felt like it was emblematic of a lot of the perceptions of individuals, particularly towards physicians, but other medical providers as well, and particularly in the chronic phase of recovery.
As a part of that research, I understand you collected interviews. These were interviews with people who had experienced TBIs.
Correct.
What were some of the themes that emerged, some of the things that you heard the most often?
Yeah, one of the things we heard a lot was kind of the sense that they were on their own and they had to do their best to find their own resources, particularly in the chronic phase of recovery. And they felt disregarded or dismissed by their care providers. Many of them felt like the care providers set kind of an unreasonable timeline for recovery, this false sense that, you know, it was just a temporary thing and after that they would be back to normal. And that made it really challenging for them when they didn't experience that full recovery, and really frustrated with providers when they would say, well, you should be past this. The brain injury was a while ago.
What I'm hearing is there's a disconnect sometimes between what the physicians are saying and the experience of the people who have had the brain injury.
Absolutely.
It's interesting because the quote that you shared, that you used in the title, is about avoiding care, but people with brain injuries, they're often seeking care. What are some of the reasons someone with a brain injury who may be eligible for care would want to avoid interacting with a medical professional? I assume it's this disconnect. Where else does that show up?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really good question. And it definitely relates to this disconnect, this sense that either providers didn't have the knowledge to provide the referrals and the resources that were necessary, so they just didn't do anything, or this sense of being dismissed or being told that their brain injury should have already resolved at this point. And that was particularly true on the mild to moderate end of the continuum. For the most part, individuals who had severe brain injuries felt like their needs were met a little bit better. And that certainly relates to providers recognizing the chronicity of that severe injury. But people with mild to even moderate brain injuries kind of felt like there was this point in time where their providers gave them the sense that, okay, we're done with this now. We should be moving on. Your brain injury isn't an issue anymore. And that became like a really important disconnect, because then they started to lose that therapeutic alliance and trust with those providers. They started to be really frustrated with the sense that they were kind of on their own. So yeah, I think that's a part of it. For the most part, in terms of phases of recovery, people are generally satisfied with the acute phase of recovery when they're sometimes receiving life-sustaining care, or if not life-sustaining, things that will definitely impact, you know, their initial recovery, so that medical care. But beyond that, they felt really frustrated with transitions from one facility to the next, or from one phase of recovery to the next, as though information wasn't passed along from one provider to another. And by the chronic phase of recovery, they just felt like they were left to themselves without a whole lot of supports.
We're going to talk a little bit more about that chronic phase in a minute. You list in the article many themes that have emerged that you're referencing here, from false timelines for recovery to, you know, providers not understanding the brain injury, physicians making the patients feel wrongly scrutinized and dismissed. I'm kind of reading through some of these. They say it's hard to get counseling. And there's quotes from patients. I've got one here. It was in a category that was called, you know, uncaring physicians lacking empathy. And it says, quote, "I think I maybe spent maybe 5 minutes with him." Him, I think, references a physician here, post-discharge. And it was, he was surprised I was able to talk to him and showed me to the door and said, "You're fine." And my wife was like, "Whoa, whoa, whoa. I can look at him and tell when he's having an off day." And he goes, "Well, we all have those," and showed me the door.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that sense of being disregarded and told, oh, that's something that everyone struggles with. You know, I have trouble with spelling too, or I have off days too, really compounds that frustration that you identify the lack of understanding of the lived experience of brain injury and the lack of really acknowledging those experiences, kind of dismissing them as either not a significant problem or something that should go away. And you identified something really interesting in that quote, which is they get this mismatch of, oh, this is really severe and you're lucky you survived. And then, okay, you're fine, move on at some point in their recovery. And that's a big piece of it.
From what I understand from reading the article, there's a sense of isolation. And I think at one point there was a line saying that these healthcare interactions can help to reinforce or create these feelings of isolation.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think when you go to providers and with the hope that they're going to be able to provide some supports, refer you to supports, you have this hope that things are going to improve. And when that isn't the case, it just makes it feel like there aren't solutions, there aren't answers out there. And maybe that you're the only person experiencing this.
I want to note another line that really jumped out to me from this article. The article reads, "It is relevant to note that many individuals also highlighted positive experiences with healthcare professionals, particularly SLPs. This has implications for the continued efforts of SLPs to engage in client advocacy and support individuals in efforts to access the healthcare services necessary." And I'm wondering if you could tell us about the role SLPs can play in helping people with traumatic brain injuries advocate for or experience better communication and more communication access in their interactions with healthcare providers.
Yeah, great question. I'm going to highlight 5 things that I think are really crucial. One of them begins with the education materials that we provide, but also the adjustments we make to materials provided by other providers, making those communicatively accessible and talking through them, reviewing them with clients is really important. I'm a big advocate of using tangible, accessible goal setting processes like using talking mats and live cards and other homegrown sorts to be able to get that person's own impressions about what matters and about what their goals and values are. We use those same supports in our interviews, and that gets us a lot deeper information about their experience and where they've had challenges with those experiences. A lot of times in the healthcare setting, there are things that we can do to make safety supports more communicatively accessible so that they're not at risk for taking the wrong medications or having another fall, another accident, things like that. And one of the things I strongly encourage, whether we're following up on our education to clients and families or about the information we've kind of translated, if you will, for other providers, use formative assessment of their learning through things like TeachBack, having them explain what they think we said and return demonstrations, especially if we're teaching them a particular skill. And that can really help things to be more accessible. And then we can start to troubleshoot some of those other provider issues as well as we help them to advocate for better services.
On a previous episode of Asha Voices, we were talking about communication access. I had guest SLP Jen Oshita, and she wondered if a lack of effective communication access could be linked to people with communication disabilities delaying or forgoing medical care.
Absolutely. And I think the issue of being disregarded and being told that they no longer have a brain injury or don't have issues that at least that provider can address just feeds into that, delaying those healthcare experiences, because you've had a bad experience. It not only affects your experiences with that specific provider, but makes you reticent to connect with other providers, especially if you think you might have another kind of similar experience with them. And I think that also relates to some of the work that we're doing right now on healthcare disparities and healthcare access for people from traditionally underserved groups. Right now, we're working on examining our healthcare perceptions, basically replicating our studies with Black Americans, because they didn't show up in our initial study, not because we didn't recruit them, but because of that distrust and those past experiences that have influenced the way that they access care, or in this case, sometimes don't access care. We're hoping eventually to do that with other underserved groups who have traditionally experienced those health disparities as well, because we think their perceptions, while there'll be some commonalities with our past studies, we think they'll have other barriers to healthcare as well.
Good point. Is there anything else that you feel SLPs in particular can do to help with some of these issues that we've been discussing?
I think it's important to recognize that in terms of providers, SLPs tend to be on the high end of that sense of trust and positive perceptions. OT and physical therapy follow close behind us, but that puts us in a position where we can advocate for them because they trust us. They're more likely to share those things with us. We can advocate for referrals. We know that people with brain injuries value referrals to community-based support groups, but not all of them receive those referrals. To follow up on your remarks about mental health care and referrals to mental health providers, that's another big gap. So advocating for those kinds of supports and providing counseling that falls within our scope of practice as speech-language pathologists as well, all very important things that we can do to really help advocate for those individuals and improve those relationships with other providers so that there isn't that intrepidation over seeking care when it's necessary, standing up for your needs and what you want.
You mentioned support groups. And I want to talk about the self-expression and identity aspect of this conversation as well. I understand you founded a number of social or conversation groups for people with brain injuries, including a poetry group. Your research highlighted things like connections between brain injuries and needs for supporting self-expression, identity. You connected it to feelings of isolation and a loss of self, the brain injury, through the interviews. With that in mind, what do these groups offer? What have you observed?
In terms of the groups, we've got a few different groups, and they all have elements that work on rebuilding identity. One of the support groups that I founded or co-founded when I was still working clinically was the Mayo Brain Injury Support Group. And that really focuses more on the traditional kind of peer support, but we do things to focus on resilience and mindfulness and ways to access that information about resources that are out there, about the experiences that peers experience, I guess. One of the other groups that I founded more recently when I came to the university, and I say more recently, but it's been a lot of years at this point, is the Bugle Brain Injury Group. And along with peer support, we use an approach called project-based interventions that use projects to kind of provide that sense of purpose and is a context for our social communication interactions. And one of the things that we've done through those projects is things like our advocacy intervention. We published a paper in 2022 in neuropsychological rehabilitation that really focus on the outcomes of sharing the lived experience with providers. Our brain injury group presented grand rounds to the Mayo physicians and other providers and really conveyed their sense of frustration with the lack of understanding, the lack of acknowledgement of their challenges in the chronic phase of recovery. And reflecting on those experiences, people made substantial changes to their sense of identity. Someone who could be an advocate for others with brain injuries, someone who could educate professionals within the healthcare system. So kind of a direct response to the frustrations that come across in the healthcare perceptions work. And we've done some things with motivational interviewing for peers and that training as a way to create an identity of purpose and a sense of worth and value in that way. One of our other groups that you mentioned is the Thursday Night Poets, and that's been going since the onset of the pandemic. We really kind of stumbled into that. I had some experience working with a poet, with individuals with aphasia from our Chippewa Valley aphasia camp. And when the pandemic rolled around, I was really concerned with the social isolation of our people with brain injuries and stroke-based aphasia, those kinds of things. The poetry is just a powerful way to process your recovery, your experience, anything that you're going through in life. So it was a good way even to process kind of the onset of the pandemic. Our goal or our initial plan was for 3 sessions, and we're probably pushing 4 years at this point. It really allows people who have a difficulty expressing their thoughts, either because of a language issue or a cognitive issue, in a way that is less restrictive and allows them to use sometimes the wrong words or different words to explain something that's really deeply important to them. And I really feel like we just kind of stumbled into that, but it's been just an amazing experience to see the growth in individuals. We've started to look at their outcomes, and there's this renewed sense of identity. You know, people went into this saying, I'm doing this because it's something to do during the pandemic. And now they identify as poets and as authors and as published authors. We've published a couple of books on their works, and we're working on a third book at this point. But yeah, it's really powerful to see them re-identify their worth, their value, their purpose in life, and start to reshape those identities. Moving from, I'm a person with a brain injury who struggles with communication, to someone who can communicate quite freely and eloquently in that modality. So it's been an amazing experience to me and our students as well.
I'm going to read a quote that was from the 2022 article that we've been referencing. And this is specifically about kind of what we're talking about, this loss of meaningful activity and social engagement, is how it's worded in the article, I believe. I'm going to read this now. It says, quote, "When I tell you I have no life, I'm not exaggerating. I'm sure you've heard that from other people, because you can't, you literally cannot do anything. Like, you can't go into a bar because you can't tolerate the noise. You can't drink alcohol. And you can't go, huge hockey fan. So I used to go to hockey games all the time. I had, season tickets. I'll probably never be able to go to a hockey game again. So it destroys your life," end quote. Someone else expressed a similar sentiment about going to the movies, that wasn't a possibility for them anymore. What other opportunities do people with brain injuries have for connecting with others and building that sense of self?
Yeah, I'm a big advocate for becoming a part of community-based groups wherever you're at, as a way to connect with peers, to hear other people's experiences, and to be kind of reminded or reinforced that you're not the only one out there. It feels a lot less isolating. Becoming connected with volunteer experiences is another really great way to reestablish that sense of purpose. And there's a lot of different opportunities. So some of them may have a big communication component, others may not. But those are great opportunities to connect with others and to start to rebuild that identity. We also use, as I mentioned with the peer motivational interviewing piece, we use a lot of peer support. So serving as a peer to mentor another individual. Again, obviously serves the purpose, kind of dual purposes, helping that individual, but also for the peer mentor, they get the opportunity to do something that's meaningful and that enhances their sense of purpose and self-worth and begins to rebuild their identity as well.
In February, Jerry published a new article in Brain Injury, a journal from the International Brain Injury Association. It's titled Healthcare Perceptions of Persons with Traumatic Brain Injuries Across Providers, Shortcomings in the Chronic Phase of Care. I asked Jerry for examples of the things that he learned about the chronic phase of care for people with brain injuries.
I would say across the board, even including individuals with severe brain injuries, there's a lack of services and a sense of the need for chronic care in brain injury, even though we know it is a chronic condition. This is really similar to some of the challenges that people with stroke-based aphasia find. There's a lot of front-end loading of services for acute and subacute kind of periods of recovery. And then once those insurance dollars are gone, individuals are stuck with living with ongoing chronic needs in terms of cognitive communication, in terms of memory, in terms of social communication and being able to reconnect with their peer groups. In particular, there's a lot of loss of friendship, those kinds of things. And from a care standpoint, they're not being referred to services, even services that are not insurance-based. So community-based support groups, which provide an opportunity for people to remain connected. I mean, we have fairly vibrant support groups here in my institution, but we know we're barely scratching the surface of the number of people living in our community with the chronic consequences of traumatic brain injury. And if we're not effectively facilitating referrals and kind of self-advocacy and awareness of what's out there, then there's a lot of individuals struggling with these challenges that we haven't met. We don't even know. And the other piece that goes along with that kind of returns to this idea that there's a sense that, in particular, not to pick too much on physicians, but that some physicians just believe there's a date and time where there's no more consequences of brain injury, and that after a year or two, or maybe three, that the brain injury is kind of over and there's no need to provide supports for those perceived needs on the part of individuals with brain injuries and their partners. So they disregard them. They push them away. They say, I don't have anything that we can do for you at this point. You really don't have any needs that are ongoing. Not recognizing the subtle high-level needs that many of these individuals have that can disrupt their ability to work, disrupt their ability to maintain relationships with friends and family. So, I mean, that's really the crucial piece.
Jerry goes on to highlight opportunities for all disciplines to improve the way they provide discharge education. And he says this is a place where SLPs can support people with TBIs as they prepare for the chronic phase of recovery.
I think in terms of preparing for that chronic phase, one of the things that we need to do is be better about our discharge instructions and supports that we give to people upon discharge, ways to keep them connected and to have someone to follow up with when challenges arise. Just the nature of traumatic brain injury is that early on in your recovery, often there is limited self-awareness. Early on, there might be that sense of, I don't need any support, so I'm going to be the person who doesn't need supports in the chronic phase, so you don't even have to tell me about that. But we have to recognize that there will be ongoing needs in the chronic phase, and it is our responsibility to provide accessible education and written resources and access to other resources in that chronic phase of recovery so that when that recognition comes around, or at the very least, when everyday care partners begin to recognize the long-term consequences and that they're in this for the long haul with their partners with brain injuries, they need to be able to access those materials or know who to call back to be able to find out where those resources are. I'm a big advocate in terms of what we can do. I think we know that group interventions are more efficient and more effective in many cases in helping individuals with brain injuries recover those complex social communication skills that particularly affect relationships and workplace abilities for people with brain injuries. So from a big picture kind of systems change standpoint, we need to start getting reimbursement for group-based interventions. In the meantime, we need to provide these services to keep people kind of in the loop and in the know about their needs in the chronic phase of recovery. So I'm a big advocate for doing the every little bit helps. So even if you're offering group for an hour once a month, that can help people access other services that they might not otherwise be able to access, and a lot of support within that context as well.
One more thing, I guess, looking towards the future here. Jerry, you're a professor, and a part of your work is preparing the next generation of clinicians. How do you address training students? Is there anything in particular you do to maybe instill or tap into a greater sense of empathy?
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, I'm really passionate about the lived experience and putting value on the lived experience of brain injury. And that's one of the things that all of my students get a heavy dose of within my clinical supervision, but also within their coursework. So the groups that we talked about before, I've got student clinicians who lead those groups, and they get a lot of hands-on work, working right alongside of me on providing those interventions, getting support, apprenticeship kind of support right in the moment within, like I said, the Mayo Brain Injury Group, the Poetry Group, the Blue Gold Brain Injury Group. But one of the things that they also receive is that all of the students in my graduate level acquired cognitive disorders course have a course embedded clinical experience where they have 10 weeks implementing an intervention for people with brain injuries called TBI Connect. That's a manualized intervention out of Australia by Rachel Riedick and Leanne Torr and colleagues. And Leanne was my doctoral mentor back in the day. So that particular approach gives students an opportunity to really get to know the individual with brain injury and their primary everyday communication partner, because they're engaged in the social communication training, the education about the consequences of brain injury in the short term and the long term, and then that communication training for partners that we do through the context of video modeling. And yeah, people with brain injury and their partners gain a lot from this experience working with the students in terms of their communication, social communication skills and strategies. But the students, one of the things that they report most is this sense of understanding a little bit more, having insight into the lived experience of brain injury from the perspective of the individual with the brain injury and the perspective of those partners, and how important that is for having empathy for those individuals and recognizing the importance of being an advocate for them, the importance of being there in those chronic phases of recovery and finding ways to connect them. So we're actually working on a couple of papers right now, one on outcomes for people with brain injuries and their partners, and the other piece on student learning in that context, because I'm a firm believer that we can talk about brain injuries and the consequences and needs and assessments and interventions needed for those individuals in class. But until you've had interactions with real human beings and make that personal connection about the lived experience, you don't fully appreciate that experience and don't fully process the needed empathy for those individuals for the rest of their lives in many cases.
Jerry, thank you so much.
Absolutely. It's been my pleasure.
Find links to the articles we discussed today on the blog post for this episode at on.ash.org/podcast. While you're there, you'll find more articles, resources, and podcast episodes on brain injuries. That includes a recent episode of the podcast on the ways audiologists and SLPs can collaborate to address the cognitive load of patients with TBIs. Before we go, Jerry wanted to take a second to thank his research team.
We mentioned Dr. Louise Keegan from Moravian University, who is an SLP, one of my primary research collaborators. Also, Katie Dahl was a master's thesis student who began this work, kind of planted the seed for all of us. More recently, Warren Brown from the University of Louisiana Lafayette has started to work on our kind of follow-up studies on Black Americans. And then Dr. Daniel Proud from Moravian University is one of our statistical research consultants.
Asha Voices is produced by the American Speech Language Hearing Association and comes from the team behind the Asha Leader magazine. I'm JD Gray. This is Asha Voices.